Hello, you're listening to Wine Blast. I'm Susie, he's Peter, and you are very welcome, particularly since this is the first episode of our brand new Season 5. And it's a pretty special one.
Yeah, we thought we'd ditch the trailer this time around. I mean, you know, we've done 4 of those already, and they pretty much say it all. You know, they've got highlights reels with lots of funny bits. Also, us kind of beseeching, but maybe sort of berating is a better word, you to subscribe, rate, recommend, get in touch, all that sort of stuff. So we don't need to rehash that again. Instead, we are going to cut straight to the chase. A world exclusive with a massive name. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you John Malkovich.
Woohoo. Now, we all know John Malkovich. He's starred in countless films, including The Killing Fields, Dangerous Liaisons, Con Air, Of Mice and Men, In the Line of Fire, All the President's Men, being John Malkovich, of course, even Johnny English. He's done a lot of theatre too. He recently caused quite a stir in the West End, didn't he, with the show Bitter Wheat by David Mamet.
Yeah, and then some. Look it up if you want to get into that whole story. But what you might not know about John Malkovich is that he has many strings to his bow. He's also a director and producer of stage and screen, and not to mention celebrated fashion designer. And now to this list we can add wine producer in the south of France under the L'Ecole de la Coste brand, making IGP Vaucluse wines.
Now, I have to be very honest and say that this fact had slightly passed us by, hadn't it? But then again, this is a relatively recent development and the wines have only just been started to be exported. We were asked to interview John live on stage at the Institute of Masters of Wine Symposium in Wiesbaden in July 2023. And it's fair to say we were terrified, weren't we?
Yeah. I mean, partly because, you know, this is a man who comes with a fearsome reputation for not suffering fools. He's somebody who knows what he likes and is perfectly happy making it clear when he's not happy. And he also plays vicious psychopaths in a very convincing way too on screen. But, you know, also because his wines are pretty unconventional, for which he's got a bit of flack from the wine community. And we were going to be interviewing him live in front of a huge crowd of 500 total wine nerds. So
the stage was set,
yeah,
so to speak. Yeah. Anyway, here's a sneak preview of what went down.
My wife suggested that we make wine, I think in the hopes of cutting down on our wine bill. I don't ever even consider in a play, a movie, anything like that, anything I do particularly provocative, even. It's just what I do, which, yes, seems to provoke people. I would advise the winemakers, if they really need to do some quick money laundering, go into fashion. You'll lose an unbelievable fortune in weeks, and you'll feel better about yourselves.
So this is going to be a fun one. I have to say, we were intrigued by John right from the start, weren't we? Not just in terms of his career as an actor and director, but almost more for what he's doing with his wines. You know, the way he's intimately involved in the process and his thinking and ambitions, which are quite unorthodox, you know, and they're fascinating for it.
I mean, and that's exactly why we wanted to do this John Malkovich episode. So you guys could get to know him and his wines a bit better and discover this largely unknown side to him and what he does. But before we get stuck in properly, there was just one dedication we wanted to make to another very special person, wasn't there?
Yeah, well said. So we want to dedicate this episode, in fact, this entire season of Wine Blast, to our friend and fellow master of wine, Phil Tuck, who very sadly died in a cycling accident recently. Phil was an inspirational wine person and a great friend. He could be pretty blunt and direct when he wanted to. He was another one not to suffer fools, but he was fiercely loyal, hugely supportive and unceasingly generous.
Yeah, I mean, I think we'll always remember Phil, or I'll certainly always remember Phil for his mischievous smile and for the hours he spent putting us through our paces as Master of Wine students. But now, as Phil himself might have said, the show, or the wine show, must go on.
Well said. Actually, just on this note, we should also pay tribute to the actor Julian Sands, who died recently and who was a great friend of John Malkovich. We did speak with John about this briefly, and he described Julian as someone of many talents who also loved to drink. And I think that's a lovely common thread to all the people we're mentioning here, including us, of course.
Including us. We have the wine glasses right in front of us to prove it. Yep, brimming glasses, ready to be raised.
Raising
so I think
now.
I think we before we launch into the interview with John, it might be helpful to have just a bit of context.
Good idea, as I gulp my wine down. so what to say about John Malkovich to set the scene? Well, he has Croatian, English, Scottish, French and German heritage. He was born in Benton, Illinois in December 1953. He was never a big drinker or wine lover, but this changed later in his life. And he cites memorable wines, including Chapoutier's Hermitage, Super Tuscans, Oregon Pinot Noir, even Californian Sangiovese, would you believe it? He says he, and I quote, drank his way handsomely around Australia.
Good place to drink your way around.
Exactly. And he was intrigued by the French Huguenot winemaking legacy in South Africa too.
Now, his family is also a pretty much a foodie family. Mm. They enjoy their food. John's apparently nifty at knocking up pasta and tagine. Mm. His wife, Nicoletta, or Nicole Perrin, an Italian-born film director and Chinese scholar, is a dab hand at Chinese food. Mm. And his daughter, Amandine, trained at the Portland Culinary Institute and then cooked, get this, at Arzak, the 3 Michelin star restaurant in Spain.
That's high level of stuff, isn't it? In the early 1990s, John and Nicole bought a property in Provence between Avignon and Marseille in the south of France as a place to raise the kids, really. So this is rich countryside in all senses of the word. It's Peter Mayle, a year in Provence country. And the nearby tiny village of La Coste has the ruins of a castle that once belonged to the famous French libertine, the Marquis de Sade.
And then they decided, didn't they, to make wine, but not in the way you might expect. In this part of the world, the classic local grape varieties are Grenache, Syrah, Mourvèdre, often used to make pale Provençal rosé. But Malkovich planted Cabernet Sauvignon, more closely, obviously, associated with Bordeaux. Mm. And even, whisper it, the delicate Burgundian classic Pinot Noir. So how is that going to work in the brutal heat, the dryness and the Mistral winds of Provence? And then on top of all of that, he even blends them, the Cabernet and Pinot, in his top wine, something many traditionalists would decry as vinous heresy. Wouldn't they?
Yeah. You can see the people coming with steaks now. You know, he's also planting other unconventional things like Carmenere and Sangiovese. So for all these reasons, plus the fact he's a celebrity, let's be honest, this was not an uncontroversial wine project, I think it's fair to say, which made it all the more surprising and kind of admirable when he gamely came along to chat with us in front of a vast hall stuffed with masters of wine.
I mean, he was really, really up for it. Amazing.
Yes.
Anyway, we obviously wanted to put these difficult questions to him. You know, that was going to be the interesting bit. And he'd just flown in from Bucharest where he'd been filming. He was with his wife, Nicole, and also Ralph Herger, who manages the estate and exports. But it was just us and John on stage in front of a capacity crowd.
Yeah, no one was going to miss this one. So just to explain, you know, for this interview, we're using the audio from our interview live on stage. It's not perfect sound. Sorry about that. But you do get a sense of the huge venue and the audience, which makes it quite fun. Essentially, we were on stage tasting his wines as we went along, as were the audience. There's a few references to that. And we were being sent questions by the audience to our iPads, which we then relayed to John, as you'll hear.
Now, on the subject of the wines, we do touch on them in this interview, but we'll also be tasting them at the end of the show, so you can find out what we really think of them. But in the meantime, let's hear from John. And our first question was, what's his take on the phenomenon of famous people making wine?
Well, I've done a lot of things that probably seemed odd choices or were things that maybe confuse people about where my interest lies. I'm an actor and a director, principally in the theater most especially, but also in movies. But I'm also, for instance, as far as fashion goes, was a life long fabric collector, and I've costumed. I've always been interested in fashion. So for me, it was more just another form of self-expression. And the same with wine, I think, when we bought our property in the Luberon in 1993, and we had farmers who we had inherited who worked the land. And when they retired, we really questioned what to do with the land. And my wife suggested that we make wine. I think in the hopes of cutting down on our wine bill, maybe, which sadly that hasn't occurred as yet. But we just thought it's great land and we didn't want it to lie fallow for years. And we didn't like the look of it unworked. And because it's very good land, we decided to make wine. And we never really thought about commercializing it until we did our first vintage in 2011, and that was only Cabernet Sauvignon Pinot Noir. And I don't think it was 16,000 bottles then, but it was quite a few thousand bottles. And even with a heroic effort from myself and several English writer friends that seemed too tall a mountain to climb. So we decided we should commercialize it. We had excellent results the first several years, and many people I know who are quite big wine aficionados like the wine very much, and so we decided to do it.
Well, should we move on to your wines? Because, yes. You know, we've tried them. Long story short, we really love them.
Thank you.
And that's not to be sycophantic. You know, we're certainly not talking perfection here. But what we loved was, you know, in a world of often bland, sort of correct conventional wine, these wines stood out for their swagger, you know, their unashamed character. They had something to say for themselves. They've got something to say for themselves. I think everybody will be able to taste that in their glasses. They're refreshing. They're refreshingly different. They're food friendly. Mm-hmm. They're not afraid to have a few rough edges. They mm-hmm. they speak of where they come from. And I think they're wines to put on the table to drink and enjoy. Was that always your aim with them?
Yes, it really was. I've always loved Cabernet Sauvignon. I like very much Pinot Noir as well. We also have Carmenere, which we're not making this year because we didn't like it. But we had two terrific years before, and we'll do better next year. But all of those are wines I like, and I don't see the point of doing anything if you don't like it. I mean, if talent has any definition at all, which I'm not sure it does, then surely it means that what you like, some amount of other people like. And if that's not the case, then you find that out very quickly. They say, we hate this, next. and as they're wont to do, and as one has to accept. So these were the grapes I like, the varietals I like, and this is the taste I like. I know there are millions of others and millions of other considerations, but I like to do what we like.
And we're going to come on, I think we're going to pick up on a couple of these things as well. There's already so much to be getting on with. But just to touch on the first wine, the 2021 Rosé Pinot Noir, and we're going to talk a bit more about this variety. But, you know, obviously, this is already different from the norm. You're in sort of Provence country, Luberon. Of course, normally we're talking there about very easy drinking, Grenache-based, pale, dry, rosé. This is really different. Mm-hmm. It's and firstly, it's It's already a little bit aged, so we've got a little bit of age on it. It's not the latest vintage. Also, it's Pinot Noir. So, you know, again, with this, what was your thinking with this rosé? I know you make rosé also from Cabernet, but what was your thinking particularly with the Pinot Noir rosé?
That was actually my wife's idea, who runs the company. She really wanted to try. We do well with rosé. It comes out quite well. We've never had a bad year with the Cabernet. And we have a lot of Pinot, but of course, Pinot in France, when they hear you make a Pinot Noir in Provence, they can't deal with that. So there isn't, and one could say rightfully so, perhaps, but there isn't a market really for it. So this does very well here in Germany and Scandinavia and elsewhere. So we wanted to try with our Pinot to make rosé as well.
Can we just sort of rewind for a moment and go back to your story with wine? You know, when did you get into wine? How? And what has your journey been to get to this point of making your own wine?
I didn't come from a family who... when I grew up, who drank. I never drank at all. And I think the first time I ever had a beer was when I was 29 years old doing a play in New York, and I had to chug beers and bounce them off my co-star's head. And which I think I acquitted myself nobly, but I was never an alcohol person at all. So I first started drinking champagne and white wine probably well into my 30s, a little cognac in my late 30s, and eventually settled on red wine. And being a lot in America, I gravitated towards Cabernet Sauvignon, and then our children went to university in Oregon, and I began to become very familiar with a lot of the excellent American Oregon Pinot Noirs. And so that's kind of how I started to drink and started to become interested in it, really. But I was in my 40s by then.
And tell us about the place as well, because everything you say, this is a really important part of why you've converted being a wine lover into being a wine producer. Can you just paint us a picture of your estate?
Uh-huh. It's an old farm, and it's in a valley that's the kind of miniature version of Franschhoek in South Africa. That's what it looks like, but in the sort of Provençal way and size. And it's in the valley between two cliff villages, Bonnieu and Lacoste being famously the village of the Marquis de Sade. And it's a beautiful place. I love it there. I love the way it sounds and smells, and never had a bad day there.
Sounds absolutely magical. Just to pick up on one question that's come in, the question that's come in is, why did you choose to plant Pinot Noir over typical Mediterranean varieties? And there's a couple more questions like that along a similar theme. Uh-huh. So obviously, in this area, you know, Grenache, Syrah, Mourvèdre, etc. Sure. would be typical.
Yeah.
Let's go straight in there. Why on earth plant Pinot Noir?
And Cabernet.
We'll start with Pinot.
Okay.
Pinot, come on to Cabernet.
I was directing a play in Paris, and the translator of the play was an English writer called Michael Sadler. And Mick gave me an article which said that Louis XV or Louis XVI, his wine conseil, Louis XV or XVI, had said, in our really parcel of land, this part of the valley, only Pinot Noir, only. Then we had a friend who had brought to dinner one night, he was from a village called Couqueron, which is just over the Luberon Mountains from us. And he was with Hachette, the big French publishing house, Jean-Claude Lattès, and he brought to dinner one night a couple of bottles of Pinot Noir he had made, which were just, I thought, spectacular. And not at all like a Burgundy, really nothing to do with, or as we say in New Orleans, Burgundy. So there's that as well. But they were really excellent. And Jean-Claude said, now, don't. No matter what you do, don't get an idea to make wine. You'll lose a fortune and you'll break your heart. So never do that. And that kind of said to me, okay, well, that's something I should do, probably. Because I'm very good at that. And those were both two things. Plus, I like Pinot Noir. But I wanted a more Oregon style. So those are the two things that inform the decision.
Because you were
and the fact that our land, I mean, we found this out actually later, but we knew at the time that we couldn't plant an olive tree, but where our Pinot ends, there's a small two-lane road, and directly on from that, across a drainage culvert, maybe this wide, they can have olive trees, they can have pomegranates, they can have etc., which we can, it's too cold. And so a very bizarre little microclimate, which I learned later was called Little Siberia. And that's just on our land. And somehow the Pinot took to it very well.
And it's tasting delicious. I don't know if anyone's moved on from the rosé onto the Pinot already, but really interesting
Pinot
comparisons of the two Pinots there.
I love them both, but I do love the red Pinot. And then Cabernet?
Cabernet was just something about Lacoste and where it is actually reminded me somehow of California, but say California 60 years ago or 70 years ago. Not that Provence is behind in that way. I don't mean to insinuate that in any way. But it's, let's say, less spoiled. They have incredibly strict regulations about what you can build and not build. And I just thought that Cabernet would do very well there. And as I say, it came out of the ground really like it had been exposed to a nuclear flash.
So just talking, to dwell briefly on the Pinot Noir, you know, it's definitely a very bold, very muscular style of Pinot. It's pretty full on. Sometimes, John, you talk about wines having a sort of boom, boom factor, which I absolutely love that expression. Mm-hmm. I think we should work that into the MW qualification somehow. That should get double ticks. On the exam paper. Obviously very different from what might be termed as your classic lighter style of French
course.
Pinot.
Yeah.
You talked about your personal preferences, just in that Pinot. Uh-huh. Your personal preference is definitely for that richer style.
Yes.
But equally, this is still a very savoury wine. It's not a kind of glossy, ridiculously opulent wine. It's still a food-friendly, savoury wine that sort of speaks of this sort of area. Can you tell us about what you like, what you don't like?
I think in Pinots, as I said, I had so many good ones from the Russian River Valley and the Willamette Valley in Oregon. They are muscular. They introduce themselves. They're not, say in France, they'd be very, very much more refined. But on our land, the greatest refinement I believe we can make is that it tastes of where it comes from. And that's not Burgundy. It's nothing to do with. It's not the same soil. It's not the same climate, moisture, and not the same history. So I like a fairly muscular Pinot. And Cabernet is just further down that line.
I've got a couple more here from these from people in the audience. Has becoming a winemaker and a grape grower changed your outlook on acting or on aspects of your life?
Well, I think everything you do, unless you consider yourself a kind of finished thing, changes you. And winemaking, like the work I did in fashion or in theater or in film or in classical music, it's only about details. You can make a film about anything. What matters is the execution and the details. And winemaking is detail. Fashion is detail. Theater is detail. Classical music collaborations are detail, pure detail. So all of those things share that commonality. That so to me, it's all the same thing. So I think I'm probably just someone who is fascinated by details. And I'm not sure that I care greatly always about the field. I mean, I've worked now for 15 years constantly in classical music collaborations. I never liked classical music. So how could that be? I mean, how could that be? Well, of course, I didn't know it. And as my father told me when I was very young, Johnny, never influence your opinions with knowledge.
I think there's probably a few people in this room who can relate to that.
And I have lived up to that, I think, my entire life. But the truth is, whatever you do, don't kid yourself. You can really find a lot of interest in it.
Going back to the Pinot Cabernet, we talked about Carmenere, Sangiovese, you've mentioned. These are clearly not typical wines from the area. And we've talked a little bit about the styles that you like and the fact that actually you don't necessarily worry too much about the field. You'd rather do what you feel is honest and right. Is there an element of you, you are famously a defier of convention. Are you defying convention in wine, or is this just you doing what you want to do and like to do and feel
the
right thing?
See, I don't see myself even as unconventional or defiant. I see myself as someone okay with doing what I feel I want to do. I mean, my father, from the time I could understand language, would say to me, no, you decide. You. Not me, not your mother, not your teacher. You. That's how you'll go through life. And I don't ever even consider in a play, a movie, anything like that, anything I do particularly provocative, even. It's just what I do, which, yes, seems to provoke people sometimes. But it's really not an intention.
Talking about varieties, Carmenere, you've planted Carmenere. Mm-hmm. Would you tell us a bit about your journey with Carmenere and your connections with Chile as well?
I was in Chile. My first real connection was with the great Chilean movie director, Raul Ruiz, who I did my first film in French with Raul. I can say quite proudly, I've never asked a director a question in my entire life, and I'm 69 years old, I've done 150 films. But the first film I did in French, everybody was talking very quickly, Sarah, I couldn't really follow what the conversation was. It was many years ago. And I went up to ask Raoul, just am I in this scene or not? And if I'm in the scene, am I playing billiards? Or am I the one smoking the cigar? Or am I confused? And am I smoking a cigar while playing billiards? And I asked this to Raoul, who responded with a 30-minute monologue of why plane trees lose their bark in June. So that was my first Chilean experience. I loved Raoul. And I was in Chile touring with a Viennese Baroque orchestra that I've done several pieces with. And I had a drink at the bar, and it was Carmen Air. And I was very taken by it and taken by the story of Carmen Air, that it was originally a Bordeaux and then thought to go extinct in the Big Malady, and then a Chilean winery sent what they thought was their Merlot to do the DNA and get an opinion of the tasting. And the French expert who did it said, well, I like it. It's very good, but it's not Merlot. And so they had Carmen Air down in Chile. And I love that it was kind of, it's like someone had put pepper in it, which I just thought was fantastic and fascinating, and I loved the color of it and the smell of it. And I then tasted a bunch of different ones over a few year period and decided that's what we should plant. The first 2 years, we were super pleased with it.
It's absolutely delicious. Just coming on to the last wine, just so we're touching on the wines again, Le 14 Quel. Now, this is a blend of Cabernet and Pinot, and we've had a question in from the audience about this as well. Can you just tell us about how this blend came about? Because I know there'll be a lot of people in this room thinking, Cabernet and Pinot, quelle horreur.
Sure, yeah.
To put those two things together. Yeah. And the French expression was deliberate because, am I right in saying, didn't someone pitch this to you? Didn't one of your original winemakers pitch this idea to you and give it and want to give it a memorable title?
Yeah, he David said, I mean, he could have been joking or not, I don't know. But he said, we should do a mix and call it Les Liaisons Dangereuses. And I said, surtout pas. but then Jean-Nathalie, who was our consultant, pitched the idea in a much more serious way. And I thought, yeah, let's try it. And we had a terrific, I think, first year. It was pretty volatile and needed a good 18 months or so to settle in. We like it. And so far, okay every year. I think this one's young because it's 21, but so far so good with it. It's not something I would have thought of either. But I do think the Pinot lends the Cabernet a little delicacy and freshness.
We did have a question. Have you contemplated any film or theatre project with wine as a main theme?
No, I was offered a part in a film that Taylor Hackford was going to do about La Veuve Clicquot. I don't think it ever got made, as far as I know, it didn't. And if it did, I don't think I was in it. But I'm never that sure either.
Now, you touched on fashion a couple of times. We were just admiring your wonderful clothes, beautifully designed. And we were talking about it because obviously you got involved in fashion. And we were just comparing before before we started, just comparing the difficulties, the challenges of making money in a business like wine and also making money in a business like fashion. And yet at the same time, there are things, pleasure and rewards you can derive from these things which are, go beyond the monetary.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I would advise the winemakers, if they really need to do some quick money laundering, go into fashion. You'll lose an unbelievable fortune in in weeks. And you'll feel better about yourselves. But I think, as I said, they're all detailed things. And my feeling is, when you put something out in the public square, I don't want to call it an act of arrogance, because I don't think that would be fair either. But when you put something out in the public square, many things could happen, but two of them are definite. There'll be people who resent it with every fiber in their being, and more times than one would wish to admit, they may be right to have done so and to have felt that. And then there may be people who will like it, or even really like it. And you have to be ready for both. And fashion, I love doing. I've certainly had a lot of luck and good fortune in my life, and I've been honored by various organizations for various things. But the biggest honor of my life was being asked to design a fabric for Liberty of London, and nothing else is even in that ballpark or even in that, on that planet.
Even taking acting into consideration.
Oh, unquestionably, yeah.
Just moving on, I have to ask a question like this. I apologize in advance. Well, I didn't apologize. It's a good question, but non-wine related question. In The Line of Fire, you were super creepy and scared the bejesus out of me. You were an amazing villain. What movie are you most proud of?
You know, that's not a feeling I'm really familiar with, the idea of being proud of something. I may have liked doing something. I loved Wolfgang Petersen, who I have to make a video for, an homage for him. He was a lot of fun. He was very amusing. It was fun to do. I love Clint Eastwood. I'm fond of Rene Russo. It was a nice cast. It was great. But I don't really think of being proud of something. I think of how it could be better. And I think any creative process is shrouded in mystery and sometimes misery, but mystery, and is constantly a challenge and constantly requires refinement and oxygen and change in some way. So I can't really ever be proud of things like that.
Just to finish on that then, but are you proud of your wines, if we put them in a sort of creative context? Or do you see things that you could always sort of do better and perfect? And
I'm happy when it's good and not very happy when it isn't. And I have a tendency to make that clear. And not in some kind of a big boss way, but I like what I like. I can't change. I'll be 70 in December. Change is not coming. I'll continue to respond the way I do to things and only think about what could be improved. There's no point in thinking about what's good. But as I always say, I've directed a lot of plays and some very successful ones and won this and that in award in America or in France or in England or what have you, or blah, blah, who cares? Certainly I don't. But here's the thing. I never once put on a play that at the end of it, even if the audience stood up and applauded, that they just demanded we start the play over again right now. Okay, so that tells me what? Not good enough. And, okay, some people would say if that's your bar, you're deranged. No, if you have to know what the bar is, and the bar should be high. So we did, I was shocked by how good, speaking of wine, our 2020 Carmenere was, first vintage, 600 bottles-ish. It was just shockingly good. But, you know, I directed a play once where the character says that when the day she was born, she looked out the window and she saw this exquisite landscape and this magnificently colored sunset, and she said to herself, she was one day old, "You mean I'm going to have to look at this again tomorrow?" Okay? That's, to me, that's normal, that you're always looking and trying to ensure something is worth putting in front of people. And for me, that's normal. Pride is odd.
So I think we're just about out of time, but I think one final question on that kind of looking to the future. What do you see in the future for you and particularly for your wines?
Well, assuming prison is out of the question, I see just keep progressing, just keep working and refining in all the things I do, and especially in the wine. Just always keep our nose to the grindstone. I mean, it's not very romantic, but that's just how I'm constructed, really.
John Malkovich, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Nose to the Grindstone, such a fascinating interview. And I think you really get a sense of the man there, don't you? He really doesn't do pride.
He
just wants to keep getting better and keep moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, he says if he's not perfectly happy with how wine turns out, if it's not good enough in his view, he'll be very happy making it into hand sanitizer.
I'm not sure he's happy making it into hand sanitizer.
No, but he just sort of...
But he's pretty focused, isn't he?
Yeah, you know? Very.
And it is all about the details. And he really... This is something that impressed me. He really wants to make wine that speaks of its place. Mm. You know, he makes it clear he's not into what he calls refined wines. That's just not his taste. He likes, ba-bum, you know, wines that announce themselves, generous wines. Mm. You know, but at the same time, he says the greatest refinement is that the wine tastes of the land. So we're back to speaking of place. And I think that's great.
Yeah, totally. I'd also, one thing I'd also pick up on is he's got a great sense of humour, hasn't he?
He has, actually.
Really dry. Maybe a bit dark sometimes. But, you know, I love how his friend tried to warn him off winemaking or he'd lose a fortune and he quipped, I'm quite good at that.
which is
quite telling, given I believe, or certainly it's reported, that he lost, you know, a lot of money, perhaps millions of dollars in the Bernie Madoff scandal. So Poor chap,
I loved his story about the Chilean director, Raul Ruiz.
Yes.
One of the other things he said about Raul was how he's famous for saying, and I quote, "If you behave very badly in your life, you'll come back as a Chilean in the next life." I love that. It's such a Chilean thing to say, isn't it?
It's brilliant. Now, we did sit down to record one-on-one with John after our stage interview. You know, sadly, we don't have time to play that now. We can maybe share that for subscribers. But there is just one snippet we wanted to share. We asked him what he found most exhilarating and frustrating about making his own wine. And I should say here that the Carve, he refers to, is a cooperative winery. And the 14 Kel, 14 Kel, is John's top wine, the blend of Cabernet and Pinot.
You know, because we don't have our own winery, you're always, wine is very capricious anyway. So you're at the mercy of the elements, you're at the mercy of the wind and the rain, or the lack thereof, or the hail, which we get well into May, we can get hail, and then you're done. And then there's, of course, just human error. You know, we're at a big cove now, and the 217 got mixed with somebody else's wine. It was a spectacular cab, ruined. It was a great year.
Oh, that's annoying, isn't it?
Ooh.
That must have been painful.
Ooh.
What do you say when something like that happens? That's really
well. They took responsibility. They were apologetic and all that. But they know what it means. I mean, you know, what it really meant is that was our only really good vintage from 2015 to until this year, and that's what it meant. You know, so we did the rosé before and the 14 Kel. So it's in the 14 Kel, the Cabernet. But the Cabernet Pure, we couldn't make. So, you know, it's frustrating. Every year we argue about when to pick, you know, because we always want late. And it's very frustrating not to have the workers we want, because you can't hand pick after a certain time in France because they all leave. It's unbelievable in France. You just can't find the labor.
So those are the frustrations, the exhilarations?
Exhilaration is just also walking out in the field and looking at this Cabernet that was planted, you know, so many years ago now, and going through tasting everything at night after dinner or before. We go out, taste the Carmenere, taste the Cabernet, taste the Pinot. That's fantastic. Just looking out, and it's such a organized, pretty, and fairly sensible, sustainable use of land and earth. You know, it's survived a lot and it still is fertile and still produces and does its thing. And that's a kind of, to me, that's really a miracle, I think.
So winemaking isn't without its frustrations, as we probably know, even for John Malkovich. That sounded heartbreaking, didn't it, to lose that amazing 2017 Cab?
Didn't it?
I mean, that must be just more than gutting.
I think he wants to build his own winery.
I'm not surprised after that.
But it doesn't sound like it's easy, you know, to get planning permission. Anyway, and it's very expensive, you know. But I'm sure the project will be evolving over time, you know, including the winemaking team. And the estate's just gone organic too. I mean, these things are always processes, aren't they? You know, you take time to get there in the end. But anyway, you know, as he says, his philosophy isn't the most romantic. Just keep the nose to the grindstone. Keep moving on. And I think that's what we can expect from him. On which note, we should keep moving on too. And just say a few very quick words about John's wines we've got here before we finish.
Absolutely. So we've got four wines here. The first up is an elegantly pale rosé, L'Ecuelle de la Coste Pinot Noir Rosé 2021. So this is 13% alcohol.
Yeah.
IGP Vaucluse, as we've said, are all the wines. And it's lovely, isn't it? You know, most Provençal rosé is based on Grenache, but this is Pinot Noir, and it's Pinot Noir with a bit of age. And it's got real character, juicy red fruit. It's got crisp acidity. I kind of get some rose hip and a bit of earthy herbal notes there. It's dry, but well balanced. And it's got personality.
Yeah, it's a bit different, isn't it? Refreshingly so in a world of bland Provençal rosé. Nice touch of age there. Foodie. Not crazy pricey at 16 quid either. Next up, we've got another Pinot Noir, but this is the time, it's the straight, it's the red version, the L'Ecuil de la Coste or LQLC Pinot Noir 2021, 13%. This one's £26. Now, this is not your average Pinot. It's a Pinot to put hairs on your chest. It's dark, meaty, muscular, quite firm and drying. It's really rustic, you know, perhaps a bit of Brettanomyces in there, giving it that meaty dimension, but certainly no wallflower. It's not a wannabe Burgundy.
No, I mean, it's not classic Pinot, but I love it. And it's very rare I would say that.
Yeah,
not
true.
Classic Pinot, but I love it. I really do. It's got a darker fruit than you expect. It's got, as you say, quite firm tannin, but, you know, I think blind, I might put it in Italy or Lebanon, maybe. There's some fresh acid, but it's rustic, like we said, rustic, intriguing. And I really like that. Then we have the Cabernet Sauvignon 2021. This is 14%, £28. Now, I'm going to say this wasn't our favourite in the lineup. It was a bit volatile, a bit baked, but it does have fine tannin. It's got leafy notes. It's quite silky.
Yeah, I'm not sure if we got a dodgy bottle. Which
we weren't sure, were we? There was some, maybe slightly. What we did like, though, was the 14 Kale, and that's the blend.
Yeah.
I'm surprised I'm saying this. The blend of Cabernet Sauvignon and Pinot Noir. We had the 2018. So there's a bit of sort of leathery age there, but also loads of berry fruit, fresh acidity. You've got the firm tannins. Again, really a wine that goes very well with food. I think it's the most complex red.
Definitely.
Here.
Yeah.
But it's not overdone as well, which is really important.
It was like a combination of the Southern Rhone with Bordeaux and hints of Tuscany, you know, proper complex, savoury, poised red. You know, really impressive.
Yeah.
As it should be, you could argue, at £49. But, you know, what really impressed us too, on a final note, was the, sorry to be rushing through this, but, you know, we're over.
Whizzing
was
through.
It was the 2020 Carmenere, which got here, 13%, you know, seriously punchy, vivid character, you know, with that classic Carmenere, roasted pepper and herbs, but also some floral notes, tons of cherry, plum fruit, definitely no shrinking violet. You can see a common theme here, but also definitely not overdone either. It's not overripe or over-oaked, which is the curse of many a Chilean Carmenere, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this one is mid-weight and it's got some tension. Great with, we found it great with charcuterie, didn't we? Perhaps a touch of jammy fruit. It's a little bit dry, a bit muscular. I think you preferred it to me. But it's not overdone, as you say, and it's a great red to have with food. Again, a bit different and fun.
Yeah, Southern French Vaucluse Carmenere. What's not to like? You know? Yeah, these wines, I think it's fair to say in summary, that they're far from bland international identikit blockbusters, aren't they? Yeah, which is
so
brilliant.
Far. We love that.
They're not for everyone for the same reason. You know, they are not easygoing crowd pleasers. They're full on, they're properly characterful, unreconstructed wines that speak of a place. Mm-hmm. They also speak of a person, you know, all of which I guess you would expect and maybe hope for from John Malkovich's wines.
Yeah.
You know, they belong on the table as talking points. They're refreshingly different and it's all very welcome.
Yeah. And with the snazzy LQLC logo that John designed himself.
Yeah.
Even though I would say, you know, I like good packaging, I think it could be a bit more impressive. It is quite basic. And then the Pinot Noir in a Bordeaux-shaped bottle doesn't quite work for me. A bit odd. But, you know, each to his own. Anyway, there we have it. John Malkovich, Le Vigneron.
Oui. So, huge thanks to John. What a superstar and a genuinely lovely man, I have to say. Also to Ralph Herger and Nicole Perron. Thanks in addition to the Institute of Masters of Wine for having us interview John and providing us with the original audio from the event. We'll put some photos and links to find the wines on our website.
Anyway, most of all, though, thanks to you for tuning in and spending time with us. Welcome again to Season 5. We have loads more good stuff coming your way. Until next time, cheers.